Here in the United States, we like to believe that hard work will be rewarded with success. Yet, there are millions of Americans who work very hard, and in spite of their hard work, they just can't seem to get ahead. There are people that surround us as we go about our daily lives, and yet, often, we don't notice them. And certainly, their lives and their experiences don't command a great deal of attention from the news media. That was something that our guest this morning, David Shipler, set out to change. He worked for many years as a reporter for the New York Times, and a number of years ago started to research the lives of the working poor in America, and now has produced a book that's the result of all of that work. It is entitled The Working Poor, Invisible in America. It is out just recently. It's published by Knopf. And we'll be talking about it this morning in this part of Focus 580. Let me just tell you a little bit more about our guest. He, for a lot of his time with the newspaper, the New York Times, was a foreign correspondent. Back in the early to mid-70s, he was a correspondent in Saigon and covered South Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand. After that, he worked in the Moscow bureau of the paper, first as correspondent, then as bureau chief. After that, he served as bureau chief of the New York Times in Jerusalem, and after that, served as chief diplomatic correspondent in the Washington bureau of the paper. That was until 1988. He is the author of several other books, including Russia, Broken Idols, Solemn Dreams, one titled Arab and Jew, Wounded Spirits in a Promised Land, and that book for which he won the Pulitzer Prize, and A Country of Strangers, Blacks and Whites in America. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, your questions and comments are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is they're brief, and we ask that so that we can keep our program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But anyone's welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana, here where we are. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's for anyone for whom it would be a long-distance call if you're here in Illinois or Indiana. In fact, anyone listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can also use the toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Shipler, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Nice to be with you.
We appreciate it. As I mentioned, that for a lot of your time with the newspaper, with the New York Times, you were a foreign correspondent, then finishing up working in Washington. And your last couple of books have been on domestic issues, on race in America, and now on poverty. And I guess I wonder, having been a foreign correspondent for a long time and written about those kind of issues, what made you want to turn to the kinds of things that you've been dealing with more recently?
Well, simply because I was living back in the U.S., I always liked talking to ordinary people in the country where I'm living. And when I came back, I wrote about foreign policy, and it became a little too vicarious for my tastes. And I thought, well, I'd like to dig into some of the vexing problems of my own society. So I began, as you mentioned, with race relations in the U.S., and that led me naturally to the question of poverty. It's a quest to understand my own country, I think.
When one uses a phrase like the working poor, it almost makes it sound like you're saying this is a special group, implying that most of the poor don't work, and that is not the case. However, it's one way in which, no doubt, a lot of people misunderstand poverty in the United States.
Yes, I think that's a good point, because a lot of people who receive welfare also work under the table, and they don't report their income. So what happened to some people when they went off welfare is they simply reduced their income by the amount that they were getting for what is now called TANF, Temporary Aid to Needy Families. But I think the point here is I wanted to look at poverty without its moral quotient, that is. The United States is a country that has a very deep ethic about work, and because we come out of a background of belief that this is a land of opportunity in which everyone who works hard and has talent can prosper, we tend to attach a great deal of moral weight to the question of labor and work and whether you work or not. It means that the other side of the American myth is a belief that if you don't prosper, you haven't worked very hard or you're not talented, and therefore it's your fault. That's the American myth. The anti-myth, what I like to think of as the anti-myth, is if you don't prosper, it's the fault of the society. It's not yours. neither of these is completely false, but neither is completely true either, because both sides of the question have some of the pieces of the puzzle. I suppose you can divide this up between liberals and conservatives in a sense. That is, many liberals will see the society's fault, the public education system, private enterprise, government safety nets that have been shredded, and that sort of thing. And many conservatives will see the individual faults, dropping out of school, doing drugs, laziness, et cetera, work ethics problems, all that sort of thing. And what I found actually is that, everybody I interviewed practically fell somewhere along the spectrum between personal responsibility and societal responsibility. Every life was a mixture of roads not taken and roads cut off by the accident of birth or circumstance. It was impossible, in most cases, to fit people neatly into the box that was defined by one doctrine or another at the extremes of the political spectrum. Mm.
Well, I think that gets at an important point and one of your conclusions, and that is if we are to try to, in the United States, craft government policy that will do something to try to aid these people, then what we've got to do is get away from the kind of polarized debate where we have people who are ideologically right and ideologically left slugging it out. And somehow manage to get those groups of people, at least if we're talking about members of Congress and people who are in government, to sit down together and say, okay, each of us is in some way correct. Each of us has a piece if we're going to talk about solution. But then something has got to be crafted that brings those two sides together.
That's right. And I realize in an election year it's a naive idea to suggest that there should be less polarization when the whole spirit of a campaign is to increase polarization. But I think the point is valid, and I don't think we're going to make much headway against the problems of the working poor, especially unless liberals and conservatives start listening to each other. Now, conservatives who see individual failure on the part of the poor and then conclude that there's nothing we have to do because it's all their fault are not the kinds of conservatives that I'm talking about. There are other conservatives who are concerned about this problem and believe that the society as a whole does have a role in helping people help themselves. You know, there are programs that appeal to both sides. The Earned Income Tax Credit is a good example of a program that appeals to both Republicans and Democrats for different reasons. The credit is, it's more than a credit. That's a misnomer. What happens is if you earn below a certain income, and it's actually pretty high, $33,000 a year, and you have at least two children, when you file your tax return, if you're a single parent, for example, you will get from the IRS a check not just for the amount of money that was withheld for taxes, but an additional amount. And it varies tremendously, but it can run all the way up to about $4,000 if your income is low enough. This is a plan that was passed in 1975 and has been expanded under every administration, Republican and Democrat, since, except for the Bush administration. And Republicans like it because you don't get the money unless you have a job, and it doesn't fund a government bureaucracy, and it reduces taxes, in effect. Democrats like it because it subsidizes low wages and helps people who are working but are not making much money. So that's a program that could be expanded, and that's been proposed over the years. Some Republicans are concerned about fraud. They're making it a little more difficult to get this particular money now, but it's still a very good device, actually. When you talk to poor families, you'll hear them say, when I get my taxes. When I use the word taxes, I'm talking about a check that I write, but, these folks are getting money, and they'll say, when I get my taxes. When I get my taxes, I'm going to catch up on my bills or buy some furniture or get a new car. And so it's an important little windfall right around tax time.
Our guest on this part of Focus is David Shipler. For a number of years between 1966 and 1988, he worked for the New York Times, and a lot of that time as a foreign correspondent. More recently, he's been reporting on more domestic issues and has authored several books. The current one is titled The Working Poor Invisible in America, and it's published by Knopf, is out in the bookstore. Now, if you have questions, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think the point that you certainly try to make early on in the book is that there are some problems with the way we think about poverty, or at least if we approach it the way often the government does, which is something which is simply in terms of numbers, of income. We say this: if you make this much money, or if you're below this much money, that's poverty. If you're above, it's something else, and that it doesn't really give you a very accurate or nuanced picture of what it's like if you live on or around that line.
That's right. First of all, the federal poverty line is artificially low. It's based on an old formula that's derived from spending patterns in the 1950s when families spent about a third of their income on food. Now they spend only a sixth of their income on food, and yet the poverty line is determined by taking the average food basket and multiplying it by three. So that's very unrealistic. And there have been some experiments done to figure out different ways of calculating it. Right now, a single parent with three children is considered poor if she earns $18,725. That's the annual poverty line. Well, you know, try to raise a family of four on $19,000. you'll see. I mean, the poverty line is now works out to $9 an hour if you have full time work, 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year. There are a lot of people making much less than $9 an hour. The federal minimum wage is only $5.15. And there's some states that have higher minimum wages than that, but still below the nine. So that's one problem right there. The other is that debt is not considered as part of poverty, and yet debt can be quite debilitating. I know a man who was poor for many years and could not afford to go to the dentist, and this is a chronic problem among many poor people. So his teeth began to decay and abscess, and when he had a toothache, he'd go to the emergency room and get treated, and the emergency room would bill him. He didn't have medical insurance, and he couldn't pay the bills, so they went on his credit report. He now has $10,000 in debt for medical treatment. And even though he has a fairly decent job as a roofer, earning sometimes $13, sometimes up to $20 an hour, he can't even get a telephone installed because his credit rating is so bad. The same happens with credit cards. I mean, people do max out their credit cards and aren't able to pay them. And one of the problems is that when you're poor, you're like a corporation that's financially unhealthy. If a corporation in that condition floats a bond, it's got to pay a high rate of interest. And people are the same way. I know a woman who had to pay 15.75% on a car loan at a time when I was offered a car loan of less than half that. This was a few years ago when rates were higher. And the reason was that she had a bad credit report from having a couple of ambulance charges on her credit report that weren't paid when her son had to go to the hospital with asthma. And the reason that he was rushed to the hospital was that she couldn't afford to live in a decent apartment. She lived in a very drafty old wooden house that was damp and exacerbated her son's asthma. So the interlocking nature of the problems really constitute poverty. It's not only income. It has to do also with housing conditions, with debt, with a sense of hopelessness, a psychological problem, the neighborhood you live in, and all of that. And I think that it's important to look at all these problems if you're going to address them, because you can't fix a family's problem just by altering one element in it. Mm. It has to be a holistic approach.
Well, that shows just how, when you start talking about this, just how quickly things can get complicated. And acknowledging the fact that it is complicated like that, and the fact that maybe one problem with our approach in the past has been that whatever your issue is, say if you're somebody who's concerned about access to health care, then you're going to say, well, health care is the problem. If your issue is housing, you're going to say housing is the problem. If your issue is education, then you're going to say, well, obviously education is the problem. And the point that you're making here, and make very well in the book, is that it all comes together. Having said all that, trying to take a look at some of the pieces, touching on the one that you just mentioned, or one of the ones you just mentioned, access to health care. If we actually could come up with some way to provide health care to that 40-some million Americans who don't have it, how much difference would that make?
Oh, I think it would make a huge difference. Doctors, there's been a lot of research now on the impact of poor health on all kinds of other elements of life. For example, if people are unhealthy, they don't work well, they can get depressed. There are a lot of, I think, a lot of undiagnosed depressed people in poor families, and they don't even know that what they're suffering from has a name, and they don't know that they can get help and that there's medication for it. There's an intricate interaction between housing and health. And I mentioned the asthma situation. Research has shown that there are lots of triggers of asthma in bad housing, such as mold and dampness, dust mites, little tiny insects that you really hard to get rid of, roaches whose skin shreds and forms a dust, and that's an antigen. In the Boston Medical Center, the pediatrics department was seeing kids coming in with severe asthma, and when the doctors interviewed the parents about their housing or sent nurses out to visit, which they do sometimes, they found all kinds of terrible conditions that violated housing codes, and the doctors would then call the landlords, and the landlords wouldn't pay much attention to the doctors. So the pediatrics department began to hire lawyers. And there was a case, a rather dramatic one, of a young boy who was missing a lot of school because of asthma attacks, and it turned out that there was a leaky pipe in his apartment and wall-to-wall carpeting that harbored dust mites. And when the visiting nurse wrote a letter to the landlord, nothing happened. But when a lawyer called, guess what? The landlord fixed the pipe and pulled up the carpet, and the boy recovered well enough to regain his attendance at school. And, by the way, the mother then was able to continue working regularly. I mean, one of the problems is that there's a cascading effect of all these factors, so that, you know, the poor housing leads to asthma, the kid misses school and does poorly in the learning process, the parent has to take off from work to bring the kid to the doctor, and so forth and so on. So, you know, addressing the links among the problems is really quite critical. And the lawyers at the pediatrics department, by the way, were not paid for by Medicaid, although it might make sense to do that as a preventive measure. They're paid for by private donations, which the chairman of the department manages to solicit to the tune of about $300,000 a year for five lawyers. So there's an amalgam that has to be created between the private and the public sector. But there's only so much the private charity can do in this regard. Mm.
We have a couple of callers. We'll start bringing people into the conversation. First up is in Indiana on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
You mentioned in the mid-70s during the earned income credit was established, and you mentioned that that was particularly accepted by both the Republicans and Democrats, and all the presidents added to it, except for the Bush administration. I was wondering if you could go about the ways they chose not to and what the reasons were, and more or less how they do that sort of thing to stop it from being brought forth where it might, you know, make a majority vote or something like that. Thank you.
Well, I don't cover Congress, but what I'm told by reporters who do is that the Republicans now who control Congress are just do what they want, and the Democrats who are in the minority are unable to get bills considered seriously unless they get some Republican allies. And I don't think there's a lot of support for the expansion of the earned income tax credit right now because of the deficit. The tax cuts that Bush put through have, you know, created a huge deficit. So social programs are not going to fare very well until either the economy recovers dramatically or there's a tax increase, I would say.
All right. Let's go to another caller. This is Aurora, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I thank you for understanding so accurately the problem of the poor. My mother lived on the East Coast and had a slight medical problem and went to the hospital. She was on welfare. And they wouldn't let her out of the hospital unless I allowed her to be put in a nursing home of their choice. Well, of course, I fought it for 2 months. And I finally had to get a lawyer to get her out of the hospital. But the point, and there were many people in the hospital under the same thing, I couldn't believe it. I just could not believe that a thing like the welfare could put my mother in the hospital and keep her there. I just couldn't believe it. And the Irish nurses kept saying, this would never happen to you in Ireland.
Yeah.
But the thing was what you said at the beginning of the problem. My mother kept saying to me, I worked so hard all my life. Why are they doing this to me? I worked so hard. And my mother did. She worked hard from the 2 days after she came here. She worked and worked till she was 83.
Mm.
And she said to me, why are they doing this to me? I worked so hard. Just what you said.
Yeah, yeah. Well, a lot of the people I interviewed and actually followed for some years work very hard, too, and they just can't seem to get ahead. I began to feel that we had a problem with welfare cheats in this country, but by welfare cheats, I mean the bureaucrats who cheat people out of the welfare and other benefits that they're legally entitled to. And the bureaucracy can be very cruel, as your mother discovered. And I think it's, I don't understand it, actually, because people who go into this line of work, you'd think, would want to make things as good as they possibly can for the clients. But I've heard so many terrible stories of situations. I know a woman, for example, in Boston who was looking for a job, and she was on welfare. She had to get off welfare. But she had two small kids, and she needed child care, daycare for the kids. So she went to the welfare office to get a voucher for the daycare center, which she was entitled to, and was told that she couldn't get the voucher until she had a job. She said, but I can't get a job till I have the voucher so I can put the kids in daycare.
Let me tell you that my mother's bills that I still have added up to $20,000 for the 2 months she was in the hospital.
Yeah, and I know, it's enormous.
And you and I paid for that.
That's right, exactly, and I think you make a very good point. We pay for this one way or another. If the society or if the Congress wants to deny people universal health care, they can do that, but somebody's going to pay for it. And I really think that I can't do the calculation and prove it, but I really think that if we invested more money in caring for people, if we came together as a nation and marshaled our resources through government to funnel money to private agencies and others to provide the care, we would save money in the long run. I mean, the more you invest in children, the less you're going to have to invest in prisons, for example. So, we need to sort of think a little more long range about these issues.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
We are at our midpoint already. Our guest is David Shipler. He's former reporter for the New York Times. He reported from New York, from Saigon, from Moscow, and Jerusalem before serving as the chief diplomatic correspondent in Washington, D.C. He has written several books, including Russia, Broken Idols, Solemn Dreams, a book, Arab and Jew, Wounded Spirits in the Promised Land, and that won him the Pulitzer Prize, and A Country of Strangers, Blacks and Whites in America. He's been a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution and senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also taught at Princeton, at American University in Washington, D.C., at Dartmouth College. His most recent book is the one that deals with the subject here that we're talking about. It's titled The Working Poor, Invisible in America, and it's published by Knopf. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think one of the things that we know is that it is very difficult to get a job that's going to get you anywhere, give you some possibility for advancement, to make enough money so that you might be able to save some, to get some health benefits and the other things we've been talking about. It's very difficult unless you have some kind of education past high school.
Yes. Well, but sometimes even that doesn't work. I mean, you're right, of course. But I know a case, a woman named Caroline Payne, who now lives in Muncie, Indiana, as a matter of fact, in your listening area. Mm-hmm. And she worked very hard all her life, and she began to apply for jobs that were a little bit higher level. And when she wouldn't get them, she'd call and ask why, and they would always tell her, well, the person we took had a college education or a two-year associate's degree. So she decided to get one. She took out student loans, and she collected credits both in Vermont and Florida, where she lived, and managed to get an associate's degree. And she's never, she now owes a lot in student loans, but she was never able to get a job commensurate with her training. She's been working mostly in $6, $7 an hour jobs in convenience stores and factories and that sort of thing. She managed to buy a house, actually, in New Hampshire, and then because her daughter is mildly retarded and needed better schooling than the little town in New Hampshire could provide, she moved out to Muncie where the school system is better, and her daughter is doing much better there. But in the course of that, she had to sell her precious house, which ended up making her no money at all, so her major asset was gone. I think an affluent family would have been able to find her daughter, some help without giving up that asset. And Caroline, I wrote about Caroline in the New York Times Magazine. I mean, an excerpt from the book appeared, and lots of people sent her money because they were so touched by her story. But Caroline is, the kind of person who says to me, in fact, I just spoke with her yesterday, she said, what I really need is, I mean, it's wonderful having people sending me this money, but what I really need is a good job. That's what she wants. She wants a good job. And, so if anybody listening has a good job to offer in Muncie, Indiana, call Caroline. I'm sure she's in the book, Payne. I mean, this is the kind of person who makes you feel that, first of all, it's inspiring to spend time with people like this because they never give up. I mean, Caroline just has never given up. But on the other hand, it's very depressing because it's hard to see an exit from her situation. And I wish I had a magic answer, but I don't. And it's a tough one.
Occasionally, there is in Washington a heated debate about increasing the minimum wage, and generally that manages to produce a small increase. And a lot of people would argue that it would take an awful lot more than what it is now to have it really make much difference. If one could increase it, would that help? And how much do you think it actually would have to be for that to make a difference?
Well, not being an economist, I get to the outer edge of my understanding of this really quite rapidly. The federal minimum wage is $5.15 an hour. Most of the people I interviewed were making more than the minimum wage. So the question is whether increasing the federal minimum would, by inference, make employers increase the wages above the minimum. And some employers told me that it would, that they, if they paid a dollar more than the minimum wage, they would increase that, if the minimum were increased. So it might have an effect above the minimum wage. Then, too, there's the other question of a living wage, and there are local governments in some parts of the country that have passed laws requiring any contractors that do business with government to pay a living wage, which can range anywhere from $7 to $14 an hour, depending on the location. And they found, actually, that their bills don't go up very much, that the contracts are not all that much more expensive, that productivity improves, and people are helped. There's some other studies, though, that have shown that different people get those higher-paying jobs and that the folks who are earning $6 or $7 an hour are still earning $6 or $7 an hour in other jobs. So I think it's a question. There's no doubt that raising the minimum wage would be justifiable. It hasn't increased in a long time, and in dollar terms, in real dollar terms, it may be lower than it's ever been since it was imposed in the first place. There's always, there's a big debate in this country across ideological lines, and there always has been, about how much regulation a private economy can survive and how much you can force private business to do things before you start putting business out of business. I spent a lot of time researching this book, talking to employers as well as employees, because I wanted to see things from the boss's perspectives. And some businesses opened their books to me, and I was quite impressed by how thin their profit margins were. There were sewing shops in Los Angeles, for example, in the garment district that paid people very little and really didn't make a lot of money. There was one fellow I met who, he and his wife have owned this company for 25 years, and he told me that he and his wife together were taking home maybe $5,000 to $6,000 a month. Now, that's not bad, but it's not getting rich either for somebody who's owned a company for that long. I met a fellow in Cleveland who runs a small manufacturing company that makes rubber hoses for hydraulics and fuel for industrial equipment. And he told me he made about 3 cents on the dollar after taxes, which he said was average for his manufacturing sector. That's fine, you know, but it's not great, and it means that the margin is thin enough that if he increased his labor costs a lot, he would probably have some difficulties. So, you know, of course there's a lot of room for increasing the minimum wage. And unionization, which has declined, only 13% of the workforce in the country is now unionized, it would help a lot. But at the same time, you know, we have to proceed with caution. You know, you don't want to, you know, do things that are going to stifle entrepreneurial inventiveness and creativity in a fairly vibrant economy. So it's a tricky route to navigate.
We have another caller here, someone to talk with in Newman, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
How are you?
Good.
I was wanting to ask more on the education front. You see so many youngsters these days coming out of high school that don't seem to be at all career-oriented or job-oriented and don't seem to have any money management skills. And I noticed that most of the schools don't even have home economics anymore. And I was just curious what your feelings were on that, because I know kids that get out of high school can't even write a check or you know, balance checkbooks. And it seems like their education is not oriented toward when you're out of school making these decisions, like what are you going to do when you get to college, or if you're going to go to college, if you're going to be in a trade. It's just like, they get out and they don't have any skills for that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think you've put your finger on a big problem. I had the feeling as I was going around that the family had forfeited a lot of its responsibilities to the schools, and that the schools were forfeiting their responsibilities, and that sometimes then they landed with the employers who were not equipped to deal with them. Money management, budgeting, and so forth is a big gap and ought to be taught in schools. I had a couple of families keep records for me for a month of how they spent their money, and it was quite interesting to them as well as to me, because they'd never done it before, to see where the money went. And, you know, $50 a week on cigarettes, for example, when you don't have a lot of money and you can't save anything, doesn't make much sense, not just from the health standpoint. And I think that the skill issue is a very big problem, because in this country we have developed a policy of college for all, and that's generally the way high school curricula are organized. But the fact is that it sounds good, but not all kids do go to college. And when they graduate from high school, as you point out, they often don't have any
direction,
saleable skills.
Right.
The vocational schools in the United States have been decimated. You know, we used to have a not-so-bad, in some parts of the country, not-so-bad vocational school system, tech schools, and those really have declined. There's an economist in Washington, Robert Lerman, who studied this, and he's gone to Western Europe and Scandinavia and looked at their vocational systems, and he believes the U.S. ought to revive the idea of vocational schools in accord with industry, that is, you know, with using local industry to help train kids in the high school years who are not going to go to college, so that they can get into work that's profitable for them and has a future. Now, the problem here, of course, is that in our egalitarian ethic, you know, where we think everybody ought to be, you know, the same and be treated equally, which is fine, you know, and it's a good standard, you're going to get parents who are going to reject this, because they don't want their kids tracked into vocational training.
I don't know that you have to track people so much, just when they're in high school especially, and maybe even starting in junior high, let them know that, you know, what they're doing, you know, you're learning the reading, writing, and arithmetic and stuff to use for skills when you get out of school. And even kids that go to college, I see so much of it where those young people are changing majors right and left because they're just floating through school and they don't have a way of nailing down a future.
Yeah.
And I see kids getting out of college and they're sitting there after 4 years of school and they don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And they get poor because they don't know what to do. And like you say, they get into this cycle of low-income jobs and bad housing and all this kind of stuff. And like I said, I've seen college kids do that just as well as the high school kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like we can't connect school with getting out and doing, you know, making a living. I don't know why we don't do that anymore.
Well, I think you make a very good point. I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but you're really on target.
And I appreciate the comments of the caller. I hope you'll forgive me because we're coming into our last 20 minutes, and I have another caller I want to get to back here in Urbana, so let's do that. Line one. Hello.
Yeah, one of the candidates in the primary put forth the idea that we needed a manufacturing policy at the national level, and which kind of ties into what the previous caller was talking about, because there are a lot of people who would prefer to be working in a factory or, you know, something that vocational training would be directed toward, and without some sort of national policy allowing for that. We're pretty much in the same situation we're in a similar situation. It's not that much different than when the country was full of horses, and then the buggy came around, and we got all of a sudden nobody had any use for horses anymore, except now we're talking about people.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the point you're making is a really very good one, and when you add to it the issue of globalization and the outsourcing of jobs, especially not just low-level manufacturing jobs such as factories and garment workers in various parts of the world, but also now higher-skilled jobs that are facilitated by the rapid telecommunications revolution, you have a situation where workers in the United States are going to have to compete on a global level, and can't build firewalls, I don't think, around the U.S. economy to prevent jobs from leaving, and that creates a lot of turbulence in the workplace. So that, you know, the future along the full course of a young person's working life is really unpredictable now. You mentioned manufacturing. I don't know that there's a lot of potential for growth in manufacturing in the United States. I looked recently at the Bureau of Labor Statistics projections for job growth from now until 2012, and I'm looking here at the list. It's interesting that the top of the list, the most jobs that they expect to be created, will be for registered nurses. The next will be for post-secondary teachers. Now, both of those require education. The nurses require at least an associate degree. The post-secondary teachers require a doctoral degree. The next one on the list is retail salesperson. Then you go down customer service representatives, combined food preparation, cashiers, janitors, general and operations managers. So what you see here is a cluster of highly skilled jobs at the very top, and then a whole band of very low-skilled jobs. And then down further, there are things, when you talk about operations managers, they need a bachelor's degree. But so I think that the middle-level jobs are not projected to increase very much. And if you're going to prepare a workforce to be able to begin at a low level but then move up into higher paid jobs, they've got to have the education and the ability to get education along the way. It's not just a question of the earlier caller talked about the directionlessness of even college graduates. It's not only what they get in college, it's what they are able to get afterwards. And that's something that a big gap that we have not really looked into filling, I don't think.
Well, I think you're discounting the possibility of our structuring policy in such a way that we would make opportunities for manufacturing to come back into this country, and not just relying on the rich investing in poor countries and reaping all the benefits only in their sector. I think you're...
Well, you may be right.
You got a ways to go here because, for example, when you look at Chavez in Venezuela, There was recently an article in the Chicago Tribune where they pointed out what he's been doing to the for the poor there, and yet our government is instigating coup d'etats against him. And then a professor called John Trotman wrote a really a book right to the point here, and that's his book was called "Does America Hate the Poor?" And he points out that and this is the thing that most people who are educated just can't see, and that is that the poor are really an excellent source of exploitative material in this country. And we put it into our foreign policy. We put it into our tax structure. The poor pay more in taxes than the rich do in this country. Just recently, the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy, for example, in January, put out a report, a year ago in January, I don't have the latest one, but nationwide, middle-income families pay almost 10% of their earnings in state and local taxes, and poor families pay more than 11%, but the richest people pay only 5.2%.
Yeah, all of this is absolutely right, and you're absolutely right on target. I guess the only point that, and I'm not sure of because I'm not an economist, is how much influence is reasonable to expect over the outsourcing of jobs overseas. I'm not sure about that. It seems to me that if you invest in your best resources, your people, you'll be able to adjust pretty well to changes in the job market if you have a concern. And I'll just give you a couple of statistics that show the depth of the problem. The National Adult Literacy Survey is done every 12 years or so. It's being done now. The last time we have statistics for is 1992. And when large numbers of adults in the United States were surveyed and tested, it was found that 37% could not figure a 10% discount, read a bus schedule, or write a letter about a credit card error. 37%. 14% could not total a deposit slip, locate an intersection on a map, understand an appliance warranty, or determine the correct dosage of medicine. Now, if these are accurate figures, we have a huge problem. I don't know how it's going to come out this time, but it would be hard to imagine it's going to be a lot better. We can talk all the time about creating jobs, but what kind of jobs? And what kinds of skills are needed to work well in those jobs? There's a whole psychological dimension that we haven't even touched on in this conversation, where people who have failed repeatedly have no confidence in themselves and in their ability to function. I remember sitting with a group of recovering addicts in Washington who were in a halfway house and were in the course of looking for work. These were tough guys. I mean, they had lived on the streets of D.C., some of them had been in prison. The last emotion you would imagine they're expressing was the emotion of fear, and yet that's exactly what they talked about as they talked about looking for work. They were afraid to apply. They were afraid to be asked about their prison records. They were afraid to be rejected. And a couple said they were afraid they'd be accepted because they didn't know if they could do the work. You know, you hear employers complain all the time about people they do hire at low levels not calling in when they're sick, not showing up on time. And when I asked one woman who is poor but used to be middle class about this, she made a very astute observation. She said, maybe those workers don't think they're important enough for anybody to care whether they come to work or not. And when I put that one to employers, it was as if light bulbs went on over people's heads. They said, oh, yeah, you know, I think you absolutely have a point there. So I think there is a lot of work to be done in making sure that the labor force in the United States is capable and has the opportunity and is capable of both. I mean, I wrote about a woman who is a perfect example of somebody who had terrible personal problems but recovered well. And she recovered because of a combination of her own persistence and the right government and private programs to help her at the right times. Her name is Lyrie Brock. She was a drug addict in Washington, a prostitute. She was homeless. She finally was arrested on drug charges, and the judge was authorized, instead of sending her to prison, to send her to rehab, which he did. And he was a wise man because he saw some spark in her. And she took rehab seriously because she was really determined to recover, and she fought her own addiction. And then she got into a very, very good job training program that treated people's self-esteem problems as well as their lack of hard skills. And she got she succeeded well in that. She got hired by Xerox, which also took a lot of people coming off welfare and worked hard with them and devoted the energies that they had to help people recover. And she now is working for Xerox at the Department of Energy, in charge of a lot of people. You know, she's really succeeded. But everything lined up perfectly for her. So I think that, my book is really about people rather than jobs. And I understand the law, large macroeconomic issues have to be discussed. But I think we can't overlook the fact that there are a lot of people who are not capable at this particular stage of performing competitively in the workplace. But they can be. They can be competitive, and they can be capable if they get the help they need.
We have just about 7-8 minutes left. A lot of other things that we could touch on. One thing that I want to get to is the family issues. The Bush administration and the way it talks about poverty has put a lot of emphasis on families and what it considers to be family dysfunction, and says that if we had more stable families, as they would define them, basic traditional nuclear families, two parents and children, that would go a long way to dealing with the problem of poverty. And I wonder, as you look at the issue and think about the kind of people that you talk to, are we talking about a lot of families that are single parent families, and is family dysfunction a significant issue?
Well, first of all, I would disconnect family dysfunction from single parent issues, because there are a lot of married couples who are quite dysfunctional. There's a lot of violence in the household and so forth. So that's number one. Number two, half the poor households in America are headed by single women. And of course, that has an economic consequence, because if you're a wage earner at $7 or $8 an hour and you're the only one bringing money in, then you're in poverty. If you've got two people earning those wages, then you're not in poverty, and it's a lot better. It's not great, but it's a lot better. So that's certainly an issue, and there's no question about it. Many of the women I spoke with told me, and I didn't ask this question, but they told me they'd been sexually abused as children, and by their fathers or their stepfathers or their mother's boyfriends or the older siblings in a foster family or whatever. And they volunteered this because they needed to cite the experience as an explanation of why they didn't trust men, no surprise there, why they couldn't form long-lasting relationships, and so forth. Sexual abuse, I suspect, goes on in affluent families as well, and I have no data, and I've never seen any research to suggest that it's more prevalent in low-income families. But it's clear that when a family is in poverty, a reversal or a trauma of that kind can have a much more devastating effect on earning power, for example. And the connections may be hard to understand, but I think they're pretty clear when you think about it. And an effect on parenting, too. An affluent woman who's gone through this horrible experience has the resources to get therapy and other counseling that can help her. A poor woman simply does not have those resources, may not even realize that they're available. And the research on sexual abuse has shown that there are reactions to it that are very healthy defense mechanisms in the short term. That is, there's a kind of emotional shutdown very often, an out-of-body experience where you see it happening to yourself but you're not re-experiencing it, and that sort of thing, a wariness. And that's all a defense mechanism against the trauma, but it's exactly the wrong mechanism that a parent needs, because a parent needs to be emotionally accessible, needs to build trust, and all of that, and needs not to be anxious all the time about the child and about the child getting into trouble or having risk and so forth, facing risk. So that women who have had this experience very often have to learn how to be parents, and there's some parenting instruction that's done, but not enough. So I think that just to summarize on this, I think that the family issues are big ones. I think they really do have an impact. You see it in many settings. I wrote about malnutrition clinics, for example, where I watched parents with children who had eating problems. And sometimes malnutrition was a result of lack of money, But sometimes it was also a result of lack of good parenting skills, where a child had allergies and the parent wasn't able to figure out how to feed the child well. I remember seeing a video of a mother who was supposed to be helping her child eat, and the mother was just ignoring the kid, and the kid was playing with the food, but nothing was going down, and the mother was reading a magazine. So then they began to try to teach the mother how to play with the child so that the interactions would help the eating process. So they said, play with your child. So the child had a puzzle and dumped the puzzle out on the table, and the mother scolded the kid, saying, you know, oh, you made a mess. You're going to have to pick all that up. And then the mother had a separate puzzle, and she held it up so the kid couldn't see it and played with it all by herself. So she honestly did not know how to play with the child and interact with the child. So all of these issues are important. Now, whether the Bush program would get at them or not, I don't know. Certainly, promoting stable marriage can help, but that's a very complicated task. If there's money available to help private organizations do the kind of counseling that would help, I think it's worth trying. I mean, I think the fact that the administration is doing this for whatever its motives, and I think they're mostly political motives, you know, there may be a kernel of good sense here, and it's probably worth, it's one of those ideas that liberals ought to listen to conservatives about. You know, maybe there's something there that can be pursued, and I would certainly, you know, say bravo if it can be.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. There is much more here that could be said. If folks want to explore the topic further, you should look for the book we mentioned. It's titled The Working Poor, Invisible in America by our guest David Shipler. It's published by Knopf. David Shipler, former reporter for The New York Times. Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.